higher the sugar concentration in the nectar, the larger the nectar load size was, and you could then draw the conclusion that the pollen load size is then going to be smaller. It's important to note this flip point between the high and low strain bees. So there actually is an area where if you get into these incredibly high nectar concentrations, you tend to see a flip where the bees, which before we expected to collect more pollen, were actually collecting more nectar. And vice versa, the bees that we expected to collect more nectar were collecting more pollen when you had these high nectar concentrations. And this time, these two lines are significantly different. So the loading in relation to nectar concentration is different between the different lines of bees. In our study, in Arizona, we have very, very high nectar concentrations out in the field. 3/4 of the bees that came back to my that I collected had nectar sugar concentrations that were greater than 60% sugar. So most of my bees could have been up around the flip point for the high, for the Africanized strains. I didn't actually calculate that flip point for the Africanized strains. For sucrose responsiveness, there's also a relationship between ovarial number and sucrose responsiveness. Cerruto, Andam, and Page did a study where they saw that bees that had larger ovaries responded to lower concentrations of sugar. So the way the bees are perceiving sugar is related to, it's correlated with the ovary size. So we had several things that could be affecting this decision process between nectar and pollen, which would affect the pollen load, other than ovary, or in addition to the ovary to look at. So we decided to look at the full model. We looked at ovarial number, so a measure of ovary development. We looked at the nectar sugar concentration, and we also looked at the colony source to try to include any other additional factors that we may not have thought of. When we looked at the full model, we saw nectar concentration having an effect on the loading. We also saw ovarials having a significant effect on loading. And we saw this relationship between nectar concentration and ovarials. We did not see a significant effect by colony source, which suggests that we may have a complete model here of the foraging decision. So how does this all tie together? Well, we've shown that there is a relationship between ovaries and foraging behavior. Ovarial number is correlated with sucrose responsiveness, which interacts with nectar sugar concentration to affect loading decision between nectar and pollen, which are not mutually exclusive, which are not independent of each other. So this fits in to create our working hypothesis that ovaries are having a regulatory effect on foraging decision by modulating sucrose responsiveness, which fits into the paradigm of the reproductive ground plan hypothesis with the reproductive organ having an effect on foraging behavior. So there were a lot of people who helped me with this study with data collection and use of various tools, so I just want to thank them and the funding.
We have time for questions.
Yes. So the question was asking about juvenile hormone and its relationship to both, I believe you said, ovary development and the foraging decision. The Page and Amdong labs are looking a lot of possible endocrine effects on this system. the ovaries, if they're having an effect, you would expect it to be interacting with the endocrine system, acting as an endocrine organ. They've been looking at vitellogenin as a possible regulator of behavior. Juvenile hormone is something that's being looked at. The way that these different hormones are interacting with each other. Yes? So the question is, did we look at the nectar concentration out in the field? We looked at the way that we measured nectar concentration is by squeezing the bees in the lab once we collected them at the hive when they were returning from foraging trips. We did not actually go out and do a survey of plants in the field, but it's definitely a good idea.
Thank you.
Substantial body of literature exists for bees and beekeeping and controlling the pests on bees, and periodically there are these anecdotal ideas that are published regarding using smoke to control varroa mites, and using certain plant materials seems to be more effective than others, so I thought I would investigate this. As we just heard about very eloquently, the varroa destructor is an ectoparasite on the honeybee. It's one of the largest parasites known in relation to the body size of its host. It feeds on the blood of the bees and developing pupa, and can spread pathogens and may be a contributing factor in the colony collapse disorder which we've been experiencing. And a high infestation of varroa mites can certainly cause death of a bee colony. It's had a major impact on the industry of beekeeping in the United States and worldwide. And the varroa mites are now occurring in all of North America and most of the world, except for perhaps Australia. The current treatment methods for varroa mites usually include chemical miticides like fluvalinate and Kumafos, which the mites have developed resistance to very rapidly in a lot of places.
This is part of the late breaking part here. The research that I'm going to show you here is research that has relatively hot off the press. And the two main people here who derive first authorship are Gustavo Paliosis and Judy Chen. Gustavo is with Columbia University and Judy is with Beltsville. And between Columbia, Beltsville, and Penn State, we've been collaborating on this project. And also I need to point out Eddie Holmes, who's also been a major collaborator. Eddie is a molecular evolutionary biologist whose expertise is with RNA viruses. So as I talked about, when we did our previous study with the Science publication, we basically had found that the one pathogen that was highly associated with CCD, whether as a marker or the cause, was this Israeli acute bee paralysis virus. And that we do think that it is potentially globally distributed. We'd found it in bees here in the United States, bees in the Australian package, and also in royal jelly from China. And we also have recently found it in samples from Canada, both in British Columbia and New Brunswick. New Brunswick is associated with some extensive colony losses there. And then we've had researchers from Spain and Belgium tell us that they also have the very identical symptoms to CCD present, and have taken with methods our primers and sequences to begin looking to see if they have the virus there as well. We don't know yet their results. So as I said, Israeli acute bee paralysis by itself was highly predictive, 96.1, and in combination with these other four agents was more predictive. And so if we look at this virus here, it's part of this group, and we had done this previous study looking at the intergenic region. And as I mentioned, it raised the question how many different strains we had of IAPV in the United States, and also how long had IAPV been here. Our historical samples went back to 2004, and we didn't have access to others. We're hoping to work with colleagues or others here that have bees frozen away at minus 80. We have known collection date, known collection site, to begin to look and see if IAPV has been present. So besides asking when and how many different strains, we've also been interested in whether this virus can cause CCD symptoms with or without additional triggers like the other three pathogens, insecticides or nutritional stress, and if the different strains have different virulences. So this month it officially came out in American Bee Journal. Judy Chen and Jay Evans published a paper in which they reported that they had found that in samples that Israeli acute paralysis virus goes back to at least 2002 in the United States. And if you remember, if you were here previously, I said that we had begun legal importation of bees from Australia in spring of 2005. So this 2002 date predates the importation from Australia. They also found it in colonies out of Maryland in the backyard of USDA ARS there.